It's a great honor and a great privilege to have the director of the Bureau of the Census here during the throes of all of his activities. Some of you asked me about my hat, and I guess it's a sign of aging. I used to tell stories about my mother and my mother-in-law. Now I tell stories about my grandchildren and other people's grandchildren. Well, during Passover, I went to a community seder, and those of you who have read that section of the book of Exodus know that one of the things they did while they were wandering around the desert was they took a census. And at this seder, people acted out different scenes from that period, and I belatedly volunteered to do the census. Well, someone else had already taken that on, and when I arrived, there were 20 children under 12 years old, all wearing these hats, and it says, I count, and it says census 5760, which is the Jewish year. And it was a very efficient census. Every one of these kids had a clipboard, and they went around and they nabbed people and asked them about six questions, and then after they finished, they gave them a sticker to wear so that everybody would know that they had been counted. No other enumerator would approach them, and unbelievably, when it was all over, they had indeed counted 100 people, 72 adults, 8 teenagers, and 20 pre-teenagers, under teenagers. And I thought of mailing this to Ken at the time, but I thought, well, I'll save it and bring it now. Seriously, though, it's a particular pleasure to have Ken Pruitt here, not just because he is director of the Bureau of the Census during a very, very trying period, but because he is one of us, because he comes from the academic community, he comes from the research community, he served twice as president of the Social Science Research Council. He taught at numerous institutions, including the University of Chicago. He headed NORC, and he was at the Rockefeller Foundation, where he was involved in research in Africa and South America. And because this is a very special time, for good and for bad, I would like to immediately turn the podium over to Ken Pruitt and let him tell us what's happening.
Thanks. Well, not only did I come from the Academy, I can't wait to get back. You know, Judith starts with Exodus, and let me just emphasize that. It was really the fourth book of Moses called Numbers, and if you go look that up, you'll see that the first chapter, the first verse of Numbers does have Yahweh instructing Moses to conduct a census. There were many censuses in biblical times, in ancient times, and there's a lot of record of of those various censuses. And indeed, there's obviously a New Testament census as well. The New Testament census of fame, of course, is Mary and Joseph going to Bethlehem to be counted, which then, of course, is the birth of Christ in a census context. Now, there's something very important about that Old Testament census. It was a count of the young males. And it was a count, of course, for the purposes of military conscription. And there's something very important about the New Testament census. It was a count for the purposes of taxation. All censuses in history until 1790 were either about military conscription or they were about taxation. That is, their fundamental purpose was to take something from the community for the purposes of the state. In 1787, hot summer, Philadelphia, founders arguing about the Constitution of the United States, moving away from the Articles of Confederation, the Continental Congress, had to struggle with lots of battles, lots of arguments, lots of differences that had to be resolved to sort of form the new union. And one of the tough ones that had to be resolved was the big state versus small state. If you recall your American political history, you'll recall that in the Continental Congress, each state had an individual vote. There were 13 votes in the Continental Congress. States were the units of representation. And of course, the small states in particular wanted to maintain that into the new union. And the counterargument from the large states, New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, so forth, were no, political power should be distributed proportionate to population. And of course, you had the Great Compromise, Connecticut Compromise, in which each state gets two senators, i.e. equal representation, and in the House of Representatives, representatives would be distributed proportionate to population. And that was one big battle that had to be resolved. That, therefore, if you're going to distribute power proportionate to population, you've got to go out and count. So you have a census. Article 1, Section 2, Paragraph 3 of the United States Constitution introduces the concept of a census. Now, there's something else going on in 1787, and very important. It's sometimes not fully appreciated. The new union is formed with 13 states, new states, colonies now states, right? But enormous wealth was just beyond the Alleghenies. You had mineral wealth, you had timber, you had agricultural lands, you already have people crossing the Appalachians, going through the Cumberland Gap, beginning to settle the Northwest Territories and so forth. Now ask yourself, in 1787, when you're writing the Constitution that becomes the founding document of the United States of America, what are the terms under which these new territories should become part of the Union? Simple choice. They can either become colonies, i.e. you could colonize them and extract their resources for purposes of the dominant elite on the Eastern Seaboard, or you could bring in the new territories as equal states. And the decision was Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio, Vermont, etc., 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 all the way now to Hawaii and Alaska, will come in as equal states. Big decision in terms of the kind of country we became. Now, since you're going to do that, not only do you have to do a census, you got to do it every 10 years. You got to keep up with the dynamic, changing nature of the American population, the restlessness, the expansion with immigration, so forth. Which is to say, the census that was put into the Constitution in 1787 was put there not to take something from the people, military, taxation, is to give something back to the people, equal political representation. It was a big break in history. And it echoes, as I will make clear, down to today. But the initial genius of the Constitution and having the census in it was that it was a statement about the distribution of power back to the people and the distribution of power on a way that would, instead of creating a series of colonies, would create a series of equal states. The other thing to take from that period is that the census was put in the Constitution to perform state-building functions. Expansion, reallocation of powers, the population shifted, and so forth. Or, put more bluntly, it was put into the Constitution to serve a political purpose. It was not put into the Constitution to provide data for the country. It was put in the Constitution to resolve the knottiest political problem in any republic, i.e., how do you routinely redistribute power on a kind of a basis that will be widely accepted. So it had a deeply, deeply political purpose. Therefore, let's not be surprised that there are partisan political arguments about the census. It is a political instrumentality, and any political instrumentality is going to attract political viewpoints. Madison, by the way, in the very first census, tried to sort of convert the census into something else. Not something else, but add to it. Madison wanted to take a census of a lot of characteristics, housing characteristics, economic characteristics, and so forth. And he was denied that. And indeed, as George Washington said, you just want to create some data so some people who scribble books can write some more books. Of course, that's what Madison did want to do. He wanted to create an intelligence about the society and let scholars, the equivalent of the social science community in the 1790s, of course, to have these data to describe the society and how it was changing and so forth. In the long run, of course, Madison won. We'll talk about that a little later, because we actually added to the census more and more and more questions of a more complicated nature and so forth, so we actually use census data now to understand our society as a society and not just to reallocate power. But nevertheless, the first purpose was deeply political, and it's always been deeply political, and therefore it will necessarily attract political argumentation. And indeed, from 1790, with one exception, to today, it's performed that function of redistributing power every 10 years. As the population redistributes itself geographically, as it grows differentially in different parts of the country, different states, and so forth. It's performed that function. It did not perform that function in 1920. Here's what happened, if you don't know your history, in 1920. In the World War I years, there was a lot of population movement from the south to the northern industrial cities. And a large part of that was African-American, then Negro, of course, population movement, but it wasn't only. It was rural movement to the cities. Take yourself back to the early 1920s and remember the political moment. This was the moment of the Palmer raids, of the Red Scare, of the anxiety about all of these radical new immigrant populations in our central cities that brought into our country quote-unquote socialist ideas from Europe. Remember that political moment? Well, you've got that political moment going on, and then you suddenly report the results of the 1920 census and say, guess what? All those cities are bigger than they used to be. And Ohio and Illinois and Indiana have more people in them than they used to. And you've got a Congress which is very conservative, very rural in 1920, and you present that result to them, and they don't reapportion. We did not reapportion after the 1920 census. It wasn't because the data weren't any good. Data were fine. But they didn't like what the data told them, and they argued about it. And we did not reapportion until 1932, till after the 1930 census. And that's a complicated other story about why we even did it then. But nevertheless, the larger point is from 1790 to 1990, after every census, without exception, we have redistributed power according to the results of the census. Now, I want to go back to the 1920 incident for a moment. What was the nature of the political battle line in 1920? It was regional, southern rural versus northern urban. And what was the political battle about? The political battle was about the application of the census results in the reapportionment process. And every major political battle over census from 1790 until 1990 had that characteristic. The fundamental cleavage was regional, and the fundamental argument was about the application of the numbers. So it's not new that we have political battles over the census. So what is new? Big time new? The nature of the political battles that began to emerge in 1980s took on much, much more currency by the 1990s, now in full steam, has two big differences. One, the cleavage lines are partisan, not regional. That is, on one side are the Republicans, on the other side are the Democrats. Almost every major vote about the census, whether it's in the House of Representatives, whether it's in the Supreme Court, whether it's in the legislature in New Jersey or Virginia, where all this is being fought out today, in terms of what kind of census we'll report, they're all dividing along party lines. That's new, very big new. The other thing that is new is that the argument is not about the application of the number, but how you actually collect the number. That is, it's an argument about scientific method. It's argument about what is the best way to actually count people. Not an argument about how, now that you've counted them, how should you use those numbers. So a major turning point occurred in our political history of the census in the 1980-ish period, in which the cleavage lines became partisan and the content of the argument focused on the methodology, on the science itself, rather than the application of the numbers. Why did that happen? Well, first, as I said, census is put in the Constitution to perform this quite important political function, reallocation of power every 10 years, so forth and so on, letting new states in as they grew and function that way. Starting in the 1960s, the stakes get raised big time. And one of the things that raised the stakes first was Baker versus Carr, which was the one person, one vote ruling, which said that all congressional districts had to be drawn roughly equal in size. And hard on the heels of the one person, one vote ruling was, of course, the civil rights legislation. Not only do you have to draw these districts roughly equal in size, but you have to draw them in such a way as to prove that there is no intent to discriminate against racial minorities. So the census data, very early, middle 1960s, is right at the core of the civil rights movement, right at the core of whether you can have fair elections in this country. Because the mechanism of finding out if you have fair elections is to look at the census data at the low levels of geography with racial characteristics and age characteristics. So you now take something that's just about reapportionment and redistricting, and you add to that a tough, tough conversation in this country about how you can have civil rights and racial justice. So, 1960s, that stake gets added to the already high stakes. The other thing that gets added in 1960s, and throughout the, and more since, of course, is you really began to gather momentum behind federal formula funding. That is, you begin to have more and more block grant programs. They start out as transportation programs, some medical programs. Then you add all kinds of education programs, Head Start, Title I, you add veterans programs, and now you've got a plethora of federal funding programs, all of which are geared back to formula that themselves use census data. The number today, as you well know, you watch television, almost anything else, the number today in federal funding is about $185 billion. It's a number. And since census data lasts for 10 years, you got to multiply that times 10, and it'll grow over the next 10 years, which means you're talking $2 trillion that will rest upon the census data in 2000. So, and that starts in the 60s and 70s and gathers momentum. So now you have something which is already political in intent, and you have now expanded the stakes because it's both about money and racial justice. So the stakes are very high. And we're surprised there's a lot of political attention to the census. We shouldn't be. The question is, how did it become so partisan as against regional? Well, because the civil rights movement itself and the federal funding programs, which are largely connected to the Great Society legislation of the Johnson administration, the welfare programs and so forth, were themselves initially designed as largely programs of the Democratic Party. And if you don't happen to want those programs or like those programs, you wouldn't necessarily be comfortable with the mechanism by which they're generated, administered, and so forth. So you begin to shift lines which were at one time regional lines, you begin to shift those into party lines. Then, of course, what happens is this gets to a fever pitch. And let me, by the way, I'm going to talk about the implications of this for your agenda, but you need to see this context to appreciate the implications for your agenda. It gets to a fever pitch around the 1990 and then since, having to do with the simple procedure of, not simple, but the elementary procedure of statistical correction, whether you would or would not correct the data for the undercount. Let me, if you're not familiar with this, I'm not going to talk about it very much. You can ask questions. If you already know the story, you know the story. If you don't, it's too long to tell the story. But let me just remind you that after the 1940 period, there was discovered by the academic community, the Census Bureau, and so forth, what we all know to be the differential undercount. The differential undercount, look, no census can count everybody. All censuses, you know, are just estimates. And it's a reasonably, you know, it's the best estimate we can make. And you don't count everyone. After the 1940 census, reported the results. And in 1941, of course, you began to get university military conscription, and you recruited, and it was really universal, and it was really well run, and everybody registered for the draft between the ages of 18 and 34, and guess what? When you compare that number to the census number, there were more 18 to 34-year-olds in the country than the Census Bureau had collected. So that's the undercount. But the bigger news out of that comparison of demographic analysis of the census data was that this undercount was differential. That is, the census in 1940 had missed roughly twice as many blacks as it had missed white young males. And so you have the first really conclusive evidence of a differential undercount. So the differential undercount kind of discovery, it's always been there, of course, but sort of systematic discovery occurs at the same political moment, that is after the war, going into the 1960s, at the same political moment that you begin to enormously raise the stakes of the census in ways I've just described. So a lot of things are now all coming together in that sort of 60s and 70s period. Census Bureau then goes to work. What can we do about this differential undercount? Aha, dual system estimation, capture recapture methodologies, do the census, that's capture, do a big survey afterwards, that's recapture, compare the results, do dual system estimation, calculate the percentage of different kinds of population groups that have been missed, and then take that estimate back to the initial counts and make the counts better. It's a pretty standard thing for a statistical agency to try to be doing, not thinking at the time that this is going to become fodder for a big political argument. It has, of course, as you know, and we've gone to the Supreme Court, probably go to the Supreme Court again, heavily litigated and so forth. Now, because I want to get to your agenda, there are many more things to say about all of that, but let me just say that the current political context is such that the census is enormously under unbelievable scrutiny. Everything that we do, there are literally hundreds of people who are paid full-time either by the GAO, the Inspector General, the subcommittees in the Congress, or something called the Congressional Monitoring Board, which is the Census Monitoring Board, which is a special operation. Hundreds of staffers whose job it is to scrutinize the current census. And it's being just conducted in a fishbowl, which is unusual for a statistical agency. I mean, it's a whole separate thing to manage. But it's happened, and it's going to happen, and it's going to remain highly, highly political. Now, what does that mean for your agenda, i.e. for data? So let me just tick off four or five things that I think it does mean. But you just have to have the big picture in mind to understand these things. First and most important, of course, is will we or will we not correct the data, or adjust the data? Will we use or not use adjustment? And since we believe that adjusted data are going to be a better estimate of the population and its characteristics, then if the political process prevents the adjustment process from taking place, I mean the data are going to be thereby slightly weakened. Now, we are doing, of course, the accuracy and coverage evaluation after the census. That's the basis on which we do the adjustment. and we have every reason to believe that we will conduct that well, and that having been conducted, we will be able to provide a data set which does have the adjusted factors. Whether that will be used by the political process is now being litigated all over this country, and we have to see. If it's ruled that we cannot use it, then indeed it will not be the data that are denominated by for the redistricting data tape, and if you don't follow all this, don't worry. But it will mean that the data that are adjusted will have a less prevalent position in our ongoing governing processes and economic planning processes and so forth, and therefore by definition for analytic work, because it'd be very difficult for you to be doing analytic work on an adjusted data set when the entire country is working with an unadjusted data set, because your analysis would be out of whack with indeed what the country was using as its basic statistical underpinnings that come out of the census. So the first big issue is whether, of course, the political concerns about the census will affect whether we do or do not release data, which, as I say, are adjusted. A second issue, which has not been noticed yet by anybody that I can tell, but I consider it extremely important. When you put the Census Bureau, as has happened over the last 15 or 20 years, in a defensive posture, and it is trying to claim some sort of status and legitimacy in the political process, you drive it to do something which is too bad. You drive it to having to justify itself and its data collection in terms of administrative needs. If you follow the long form debate, you will have heard me say many times, and I will have to continue to say it because it is true, even though I don't always like saying it, that every question on the long form is put there because it serves a programmatic administrative purpose. It helps organize this several hundreds of federal funding formula. But think about what that sentence means. Think about what that sentence means. It means that we are now not explaining a census in terms of a public good. We are not justifying and arguing for a census which, to go all the way back to Madison, has the purpose of making this society more intelligent about itself. Indeed, we have, and we're in a very defensive posture and have been for two decades, and that part of the response when you're in a defensive posture is say, oh, well, we are very useful to you. We are extremely useful to you. You can't do your task in this agency and that agency, and you can't do this kind of piece of legislation unless you have these census data. But that means you shrink the data collection operation and the themes on which you collect data down to the narrowest purposes of the administration or of the state. That's not wrong, but it is crippling, if you will. This, the most central, most important data collection operation in the country, cannot be kind of liberated to somehow ask some questions or get some data that are just important for the society to know. And that's one of the consequences of this political environment that I think has gone unnoticed and unwritten about. It's not unlike the argument that took place when Thatcher came to government, of course, in Britain. It's the same thing. The census in Britain was a public good, and during a conservative period, it got shrunk from being a public good to being serve the purposes of the state. And in the long run, that's not unhealthy. That's unhealthy, I think, for a society, for a democracy. But that's one of the consequences. So again, I'm saying this political environment has had implications. So first, will you be able to correct the data? Second, will you be able to reclaim at some point the grounds that data are, after all, a public good, and the government has a responsibility for providing public goods and not just collecting data that it itself needs to administer its own programs? The third issue that I would bring to your attention really does have to do with the long form itself. Eruption of brouhaha about the long form during the kind of the key period of middle March to early April was such that it did drive down long form response rates, we believe. The differential response rate between the short form and the long form in the mailback period of a census in 1990 was 6%, and in 2000 it's 12%. You doubled the drop-off in long-form responses in 2000, and there's plenty of both anecdotal evidence and some systematic survey evidence to suggest that that is a result of the radio talk show host and so forth, the kind of public outcry about this invasive thing, etc. So you now start with a long form, and we do not know if we'll be able to catch up with that differential during the non-response follow-up period. We just don't know yet. We're out there getting it, but we know a lot of people, this is anecdotal, when you go to the door and you say, aha, guess what, you're a long form recipient, and they say, too bad, I'm only giving you short form questions because I've been told that I don't have to do this and so forth and so on. So we may have a differential long form, short form response in the whole census, which will be quite substantial and therefore quite serious for data quality purposes, especially if it's geographically clustered. Obviously, if it just kind of settles across the entire country, we can statistically correct for that. But if you really have big hunks of the country where you've got a big drop off on the long form, it will have obviously data quality implications. Also, you've got the problem of item non-response. Item non-response, of course, we already know about the pattern of item non-response in previous long forms, but we have every reason to believe we're likely to have much higher rates of item non-response because of the political arguments about the long form. Anyway, I just want to let you know that that is there. If you think it's trivial, wait till you try to analyze the data. If we do have high degrees of item non-response or drop-offs in overall long-form response rates. But it's also set up something else, because the brouhaha is now set up a quite sustained critique of the long-form data, period. There are now six pieces of legislation that have been introduced into the United States Congress to do away in one way or the other with the long-form. Six pieces of legislation that the census can only ask most basic kinds of questions in order to just do the enumeration, constitutional enumeration, and so forth. Some parts of that legislation, more balanced, say, well, no, the Census Bureau can still ask long-form kinds of questions, but can't make it mandatory. It's no longer part of the census in that sense. There is now one proposal that's been introduced into the political process. This is not yet legislation, but it's been introduced by an independent agency. I say, you know, obviously lots of things happen, don't worry about them. This particular independent agency was the agency that did bring the suit, that did win in the Supreme Court on whether we could or not adjust for apportionment reasons. So it's not a trivial actor in the thing. And that particular proposal is basically dismantle the Census Bureau, make the Census Bureau only that does the enumeration count, and then put long-form data collection kinds of things elsewhere, scattered across the federal government and different agencies and so forth. So there's a lot of very heavy political conversation going on right now, very heavy, about the using the long-form as the vehicle for quite serious attacks, as I say, on that particular part of our data collection operations. I don't think personally that many of these things will become law, but I do think there will be further compromises down the road in order to keep them from becoming law that will then have consequences for the quality, extensiveness, and so forth of long-form data, which, after all, the data that we're primarily talking about, the short-form data are obviously pretty basic, and for all the reasons that you want to be able to produce data for your users and so forth, is the long-form data that they of course most need. Then I think finally, this entire conversation plays out and will play out increasingly in a political moment in which privacy is on the agenda in a way that it hasn't been before. And just to underline that, and then I'll be happy to take your questions. The privacy debate is going to get bigger, and it's going to get bigger in this society because we are on a collision course as a society between our insatiable need for information and our deep values of privacy. Now, you and I know that census data should be held harmless in the privacy conversation. That census data do not have to do with privacy. And they have to do with statistical aggregations. That the Census Bureau doesn't try to follow individuals and know who they are and so forth. We want to know what the composition of the household is on April 1st, and then use that to kind of create our statistical picture of American society. We are not about individual level information in the way that even the Social Security Administration is. It actually has to know about particular individuals, where they did or did not work, and how much money they made, and so forth and so on, in order to administer the Social Security program. Now, there are parts of the government which actually care about individuals in the society. INS cares about individuals in the society, and of course, the law enforcement agency, Census Bureau, doesn't. You know, if you answered your form on April 1st and then moved on April 2nd, we're not going to try to follow you. We don't care where you went. All we want to know is who was in that household on April 1st. So, the fact that the census itself is not in that privacy conversation on an objective basis does not mean it's not in it. It's in it big time. There's a congressional commission already beginning to hold hearings about privacy, in which the census and the long form are one of the leading objects on the agenda items. So even though we know better, the political process, for its own reasons and purposes, is not treating the Census Bureau that way. I remind you that if you follow this story, the Japanese internment issue in 1940-41, which is a very dark history period, it was a very bad moment for the Census Bureau, no doubt about it. Small geographic area data were shared in such a way as made it easier to round up Japanese citizens and intern them. Bad moment. We put in things, all kinds of reasons. I can tell you that story is reverberating out there in the community. I go on talk shows, Dave's, I interact with lots of people, and I get asked hundreds of times about how can I say that census data are confidential when you did what you did in 1940. And that was just simply small. That wasn't individual data, by the way. That was just small geographic area. Data. Let me play it out hypothetically. Let us say there are a series of successful terrorist attacks in the United States in the next 3 or 4 years. Serious, successful ones. Bombings like World Trade Center, nerve gas, what have you, in the subway system. And there is some reasonable evidence that traces that back to a particular rogue state. You do not think the Census Bureau would be under pressure to say, where are there people in this country congregated and concentrated who come from that rogue state? Same kind of pressure that was administered in the 1940 period. If the country is at risk, serious security risk, we will be under pressure. Will we be able to resist it? I hope so. I hope we'll be able to do it better than 1940. But don't underestimate the anxiety that the Census Bureau has about having small geographic area data that would allow our data to identify where particular population groups are concentrated against that kind of scenario. And it's not a far-fetched scenario. So one way or the other, we are caught up in this very, very serious new conversation that's going to go on in this country about privacy. Now, you all know, and I know, that what's really generating is what the banks are doing, what commercial firms are doing, and the cookies in our internet search systems and so forth and so on. But there will, nevertheless, the census will become a vehicle for a different political conversation now. And it's at a moment when the census is particularly vulnerable because of this. So I went through all of that history to give you some idea of the important context in which all this is happening. So the stakes for data quality, because of the politics, are very high. And as I say, they include whether we will adjust or not adjust. They include whether we have got good long-form data to give you in the first place. And then they go right from that, as even if we do, hopefully after 2000, they go to whether what will be the unfolding politics of the long-form data, the whole questions of invasion and privacy and so forth. And then they go to the really basic issues of confidentiality, which is small geographic area data, of course. Can you really be sure, Census Bureau, that you will not do what you did in 1940? And it's very hard to make that argument. So that's the context in which all this is going to play out. And it's very high stakes politics for lots of different powerful actors, many of whom actually don't actually care much about the census. But the census is a vehicle for the playing out of these political situations. So I want you to have a realistic sense of what the political context is, as I do believe they will affect data quality, both out of the 2000 census and into the future. So with that, I'll happy to take questions.
Thank you. I just would like to make a comment. We were talking earlier, and perhaps it's tactless to say it, but I will anyway. One of the things I've learned over the years that is that census has truly been a friend to the academic researcher. But as far as Congress is concerned, the academic researcher and the needs of the academic researcher have kind of zero value. And so it's really the needs of the state and local government people, of industry, of unions, business, of all of those people. And maybe they can have some clout in terms of the preservation of the long form. Certainly more clout than the academic community can have.
Yeah. Well, let me just quickly turn that into a question if I may. I'm trying to set the political context for you. I certainly do not want anyone in this room to leave thinking that we will not continue to collect long-form data. I think we will. I think the country, as I say, we're on a kind of collision course between our insatiable need for information on the one hand and our value of privacy. And these are both very important values. You can't run a knowledge economy without information. And I think gradually the U.S. Congress and the business community will come to appreciate how critical this data set is. And my guess is we will be able to kind of work out a solution. We hope it's the American Community Survey, where we take the long-form data course and spread it across the sample across the decade rather than waiting for the next decennial. All kinds of important innovations are in the works. And I don't want anybody in the room to leave thinking that there isn't, in my judgment, long-form data are really at risk in some big sense. But in smaller ways, there are serious issues which do go to data quality, and there will have to be some compromises made, I'm sure, in order to get past this political moment that's been created in 2000. But please don't go out and say the director said that he thinks long-form data won't be around. They will be around one way or the other. You simply need them. You can't govern the country. And you can't actually do serious economic planning, let alone all kinds of other social sector needs outside the government, which use basically long-form data. And so one way or the other, the society's got to have it, and we will figure out. Now, it would not be good, I believe, to try to get the long-form data collected agency by agency. You will end up with really, data deterioration will set in pretty quickly if you try to have, the Veterans Department collecting data on veterans, and HHS trying to collect income and poverty data and so forth, and health. It's the way we're now doing it as a society, the national statistical system, is actually a much more intelligent way. I hope that will prevail, but it will be a tough conversation. Anyway, questions? Comments?
I think it may be helpful to look from a different perspective on what you just said about the needs of society for information and concerns about privacy, and what is the Congress acknowledges. When I recently read the new paper from the EU about the Lisbon Conference and the call for creating the European research space, I wondered how much progress they have made in acknowledging the need for social science infrastructure and for the call for indicators about social developments within Europe. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is to learn about identity building of societies and the European society.
Yep.
That takes me back to the beginning of your presentation, when you stated that there has been dispute about the census ever since the 18th century. The question here would be, what was first, the cleavages in the society, or the census data which made the cleavages visible?
Mm-hmm.
So is it a dispute about the data which delivers the arguments, or is it a dispute about the progress as the cause of
let me try to very quickly touch on both of those things. I certainly think that I'm a political scientist who's steeped in Madisonian sort of political theory. I think partisan differences in this community and all communities pre-exist. obviously, but they're serious. There are various viewpoints about how best to have a society and so forth, and there are always going to be, to use Madisonian terms, there are always going to be factions that have different contending viewpoints. I actually think that is healthy for society, and that's one of the ways I think our democracy has functioned, is trying to create a ongoing political process that acknowledges and reflects what are really quite sort of different sets of contesting interest. And the census is only one of very, very many things around which those contesting interests are going to argue. And so that's all I meant to suggest by that. With respect to your comment about social indicators, this country has had an on and off flirtation with the idea of a social indicator series. It was first broached back in really the mid-60s. Serious technical effort went on, as well as some governmental response to that effort. Social Science Committee kind of invented social indicator analysis, did a lot of good work. And then bits and pieces of it, it survived. If you look, Science Indicators, for example, published every 2 years, came out of that early social indicator movement. But as a theme in American governments, where you actually do social indicators and calibrate the sort of the health of the society, it's never taken off. It's out there. There's a new book out just recently on the health of using social indicator analysis. Economic indicators, of course, has taken off big time, and the country does govern itself with all kinds of economic indicators, many of which, of course, come out of census data, and they're corrected back to the basic census. So if you have an uncorrected census, then you've got uncorrected economic indicators, of course. Bureau of Labor Statistics, if you don't know it, actually calibrates all of its surveys back to the corrected data from 1990, and if they had not done that, their estimates are they'd be underestimating the labor market and participation by about 1 million people, and so they have actually been working off of the corrected data set since 1992, a little known fact, but a quite important fact. But we take our economic indicators very seriously, and but social indicators, which are kind of indicators of the health of the society, mortality rates and illiteracy rates and so forth, there's a lot of work like that that goes on. You see that those results all the time, but it doesn't kind of combine into a social indicator report, white papers, the way you do in Europe and so forth. It just hasn't caught on, and it would be a different topic. It would take a long time to try to explain why it hasn't caught on in American society. I think it is part of our political culture why it hasn't, but I won't go into it now.
May I violate everybody's privacy by asking, the last question came from Eckhart Mockmann from the Central Archive in Cologne, and would the rest of you, as you ask questions, identify yourselves? Thank you.
Peter
Burnham,
University of Edinburgh. It seems to me that two or three repeat questions and remarks that need to be made. The idea of a society knowing itself, well, it cannot know itself perfectly, and that's we need to accept that straight away. In doing so, somehow I think we've got to recognize that the long form and the census gets in the middle of our debate, necessarily, because there is an argument on one hand about how much effort do we go into in order to learn about ourselves? And the census is this large imperial act which collects, which everybody has to do. It's a fulsome law that you must comply. And the long form's on the edge, but it's not the short form. The long form can get longer and longer. It goes towards knowing more and more about society by asking questions, asking people with a rule of law to do so. I think the second question remarking here is to do with the relationship between what should be severe academic and scholarly debate about the value of that census and the long form, and the exposure that there is to journalism, to the media, nevertheless who might be involved in political arguments and the rest of it. So just as you say that as a school agency you are in that whole pitfall, I think there is a long-run and terrible problem with academic discourse, and scholarly discourse, and as it works with government in making arguments, that we are also in that goal as well. And the danger of pop socialism, the pop sociology, or pop, the ease with which somebody can go on a chat show and agrees to go, before we had the rigor of argument and debate and deciding that that really right idea actually was a load of rubbish. And I think that's a major problem that we've got.
Yep.
I don't know whether there's an answer to it, but I think that it's inevitable that you must be in this very difficult position on the long form particularly, because it's to do with compulsion, it's to do with large numbers rather than small numbers, it's to do with more information rather than little information, and the necessary business that we have of asking questions, of being critical, especially after a census is carried out.
Yeah. No, it's well said, and I won't... the many, many dimensions of your comment to respond to. I would say on one piece of it, the kind of unpeer-reviewed pop sociology issue, there's the unpeer-reviewed sort of commentary on the society using, the data to do so, is a growing feature of our public discourse. And it is extremely, can be extremely harmful because it has not been tested, it's not been rigorously analyzed. Argued about in the academic community, and it's extremely important, it seems to me, to keep in public discourse a lot of space for social science commentary that has been subjected to those kinds of tests. Now, I think it's a big issue. I don't personally have a solution to it. I do know that another hat I wore once, the Social Science Research Council, took that up and actually looked at some processes that we could try to put in place that would help compensate for some of the same. But it is a serious issue, and it will grow, is the point. The larger issue, you're right. Look, I put it this way sometimes. Information is the infrastructure to a knowledge economy, the way that canals and railroads were the early infrastructure for an industrial economy. So we're going to have information flows. You cannot govern a knowledge economy without information flows. The tough issue is what will the terms under which that information is collected be? To what extent will that become a federal responsibility, i.e. a public good? Or to what extent will that be privatized, commercialized, bits and pieces of here and there by different kinds of organizations in the society? Whether the American people will have an obligation to give information so you create this infrastructure. You know, we had right of domain when we wanted to build the railroads across the frontier. You used right of domain because it was judged that it was a better public good than the private property right where the railroad tracks are supposed to go. And information is kind of like that. There is a public value of having good information, but that is not well understood. As I say, the whole idea of information, census data information as a public good, is now not part of the political conversation, and we need to get it back in. That, I see, is the task of the social science community. They do understand the notion of a public good. After all, they invented the concept, and they can, I think, be a very forceful voice on behalf of that information is not just, and not couched, to go back to what Judy said, not couched as we want it for our research. That doesn't sell very well in Congress. But a larger argument, about the society needs intelligence about itself, does have more currency. Please.
Peter Thomas, I think it's hard. When talking about this in the larger framework, but you also mentioned that the long form, really everything that's on the long form has an administrative or legislative purpose. So it's not just a research tool in any sense of the word. Well, how does Congress respond to that, and what is their proposal for replacing that information that is needed for administrative purposes?
Sure. Well, there are, of course, some members of Congress who disagree with the program purpose to which those data are collected. Therefore, they would say, if you don't have the data, you don't have the program. And one of the ways to kind of get rid of the program is to get rid of the data, because you can't do the program without the data. That's a pretty, I don't mean to stress that overly. But more thoughtful people will simply understand that, look, these are laws. The census data is itself a law, and it is not a pick-and-choose exercise. We're supposed to ask all these questions to everyone. That's what the design and the law suggest. And the particular data themselves each connect back to a law or a program. Therefore, the more thoughtful people who say, well, we don't want you asking those questions to the American people, will actually have to come back and do something about the law itself, or change formula funding. The arguments are tricky, and I don't want to overstate it. You take a question that got so much ridicule in the talk show circuits, can you bathe yourself? Obviously, we're trying to get a powerful indicator of disabledness, and this is a good indicator, you know, in a census environment. Obviously, in a different survey environment, you can do all kinds of probe questions, but in a census environment, the question whether you can bathe yourself is actually a very good indicator of disabled status, and it's also a very good indicator of elderly conditions. So you take the problem of citing veterans' hospitals, right? You want to cite a veteran hospital where there are elderly veterans, so you ask a question on veteran status, you ask a question on age, and where there's a high percentage of those elderly veterans who are in a quasi-nursing, they need nursing care. After all, they fought in World War II, you know, they're old gentlemen, or the Korean War. So the administration, the Veterans Administration, since they're trying to cite its limited resources, it wants to put them in the right parts of the country. Nursing care and veterans hospitals for elderly women. Now, so you ridicule an item like that. It's easy for the talk show host to kind of, you know, since we don't care if we can bathe ourselves. And it's very difficult to get the public to appreciate how that item is going to work in some serious social function, which is citing of veterans hospitals. So you just have to do this. You just have to keep coming back and trying to make the arguments as best you can and hope it will seep into the... Don't overestimate the willingness of the United States Congress to pause and have these sort of serious conversations. They got lots of things they're doing. There's a lot of heavy politics going on, certainly in election year, even heavier. You're going to have to, we collectively, are going to have to protect the quality of data in an environment which doesn't start from the premise that data are particularly relevant. It's a political process which starts from the premise that there are contesting interests. My interest is this is yours, and we're going to fight about these things. Whoever's got the most votes wins. That's the Madisonian political process. More than what are the... But that's true not just of census data. That's true of arms control legislation. That's true of the whole biodiversity movement in agriculture. All of those things are being argued about politically in terms of political symbols rather than in terms of the evidence. Now, that's the culture we live in. Please.
Tom Ferris from Harvard University. I wanted to query you a little bit more on these informational public goods, like the census. It seems like you're not the only provider of these in the U.S. government that are under attack. There's the Federal Depository Library Program, the Toxic Release Inventory, EPA, and others. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that as a larger process.
Yeah. Fair enough. It's an important question. I mean, I'm not very articulate on this or informed on this, probably because I've been very busy in the last year or so. I sort of focused on this thing rather than some of the larger issues. I do think we will start focusing on some of these issues. We do have interagency conversations, but I'm afraid that the instinct of any agency which is fighting for its budget in the U.S. appropriations process will do what indeed the Census Bureau did when it felt defensive. It sort of said, look, we are really very important for your needs. And whether that's EPA or what have you, they will constantly be trying to justify their existence in narrower and narrower terms. It is worrisome because it does mean that you end up kind of crimping the data in ways that are not really functional for a deeper kind of comprehension of the society. So you're quite right. I can't do any real detailed analysis of how widespread it is. We do talk about it a lot. We have interagency meetings, but it's a funny political moment. It's separate from census, but going into election year or into an election year, a lot of lame duck people, of course, in Washington, especially in the agencies, believe they'll be moving on one way or the other after the election. And so it's not a moment to sort of kind of collect around some big argument. And it won't reemerge until really after the new administration, whichever it is in power. So it'll be next spring, I think, when we have to get back to these issues. Please. Starting with me, and for those of you who don't know this interesting little fact, I am the only head of a major statistical agency in the world, as best we can tell, but certainly in where you have serious statistical agencies, who is serves at the pleasure of. I does not have a term appointment. All other heads of major statistical agencies, including other statistical agencies in the United States government, by the way. The Commissioner of Bureau of Labor Statistics is a 5-year term. And that's true, I think, across the system. Everybody, just like NSF is a term appointment, NIH is a term appointment. The head of the Census Bureau is not a term appointment. That is, I didn't have a, I can be asked to leave tomorrow morning by the president. I serve the pleasure of the president. When the president leaves, I leave. Which is to say that even if it's a Democratic administration, I would have to be re-nominated and reconfirmed. That is, my tenure wouldn't carry over even into a Democratic administration. I'm a person of the current administration, and that's unprecedented across the statistical systems. I'm correct about that, Myron. Sir, I don't know anyone else, and I've been told that's not true in Europe. Anybody else whose term is like my term. Now, I start with that. However, here's the good news. I mean, that's the good news too, I guess. I don't know. In the entire Census Bureau, which if we're in, and of course now I have about 500,000 employees, 600,000 employees, but we don't normally have that many. When the decennial's over and we shrunk back to our 7,000 and 8,000 kind of basic employee base, in the entire Census Bureau,